Find his work for USA Today on the website, usatoday.com, or you can check the reservation desk at your local fine hotel. Become a follower on Twitter. The handle is at George Schroeder. He's our Wednesday leadoff guy. How are things in your world, George?
Things are good. How are you?
Great. So as a national writer who covers college football, we know recruiting is critical, the foundation of successful programs, but you can't get into detail about 70 Power 5 programs, the other 55, 57 FBS. So do you look for interesting angles, intriguing stories? George, how does your job dictate you approach LOI Day each year?
Well, we basically what you said. I mean, we have some guys who cover high schools, and they get a little bit more whole hog sort of into the team rankings and things like, and player rankings and things like that than the college's staff or the guys who cover colleges. But what we try to do is go find an interesting story. So I am, of all places, in Waco, Texas today, where I spent the day with Matt Rhule, the new Baylor coach, who is trying to put together a staff, and he started a recruiting class, and he started basically from scratch. And look, new coaches do that. Obviously, Willie Taggart has had to play catch up in Eugene because you're scrambling to put together a staff and to catch up with the other coaching staffs that are recruiting against you, and you know, hold on to commitments and everything else. But with Baylor, they had one commitment. One commitment when that staff, when Matt Rhule got there and began hiring staff. And so it was, you know, a little bit different situation than most places because we all know why they had one commitment, because sure, the entire staff was getting let go after the season because Art Briles had been fired because of this sexual assault scandal that, you know, new revelations, or at least, let me put it this way, allegations seemed to come out every other day. And so it's an interesting story. It's not necessarily the most heartwarming of stories, but let me start with this. Matt Rhule and the new coaching staff have been brought in to clean the situation up, and so it's a fascinating story about what they've tried to put together.
You know, I've said this before. I did not know this day existed until Mike Bellotti became Oregon coach in 95. But as a college football guy, are you surprised what a beast it's grown into? Or when you consider the BCS is now 19 years, big dollar networks, social media, does it just kind of fit in with how enormous major college football's become?
Yeah, and look, the growth of it is probably credit or blame, depending on how you want to look at it, probably both, is due to a lot of factors, including the fact that it's easy, lucrative programming for ESPN. But before ESPN started going wall-to-wall with it, you know, for, 12 hours or 15 hours or whatever it is now on signing day, it was already a huge deal, obviously. I mean, and I think it's because, I don't know, there's a whole lot of sociological reasons, including the fact that, I don't know if you figured this out or not, but every team wins on signing day. Every team met every need and got a bunch of players that are really athletic and high-character guys and blah, blah, blah. And look, and I'm being a little facetious, but I do think there's something to sort of the hope that engenders among fan base. And that's why, look, and it is crucial that you get good, talented players who are good people who are going to grow into better players and help your program win. And that obviously doesn't always happen. Sometimes the classes aren't good. So it's crucial that you get those. But I think when it comes to fan bases and the reason it's grown into that monster that you're talking about, it's in part because of the hope that kind of comes along with it that this is the class, or this is one of two or three in a row that's going to change our program or take us to the top or keep us there or whatever the case may be.
George, you're talking about new coaches at Baylor, here at Oregon, Willie Taggart's here, and you look at this team, you look at his recruiting class, and it's solid, but you look at this team he's got coming back as well, where it looks like, we won't call him a superstar, but it looks like they've got a good quarterback in Justin Herbert, a lot of talented players offensively, and the questions are on defense with this group after a 4-8 season. What's a fair expectation for Taggart in his first season? Because he came in as a heavy recruiter. He did a pretty good job of getting a team who was, I think, 44th or 45th when he got hired in the team rankings, now top 20-ish class. What's a fair expectation for him on the field, though?
Well, I mean, you mean other than 15-0? I'm kidding.
You've been here locally and now also nationally and have a good perspective of both sides. What would be a fair expectation? Because, you know, Oregon fans are already saying, you know, it's going to be a great year next year.
Well, what's fair and what's a fair expectation versus what is the real expectation? And I don't mean realistic. I mean what the expectation actually is,
right. The
real expectation. So I think what's a fair expectation versus what the expectation actually is probably not the same thing. I think a fair expectation is to go back to a bowl game and to build incrementally over the next couple of years. I think that's a fair expectation. Well, I don't necessarily mean 6 wins or 7 wins or
right.
8 wins, but I mean be a bowl team. And I mean begin to show some progress in that you don't have sort of the embarrassing losses that have come. The Alamo Bowl was an embarrassing loss. The loss to Washington was an embarrassing loss. Don't have those kinds of things, especially against the Washingtons of the world, your big rivals. And so I think you have to see progress, and I think progress probably includes a bowl game. That's a fair expectation. Is it the real expectation? I don't know. My guess is the real expectation is 8-4 or maybe 9-3 and you beat Washington, or who knows what can happen because Justin Herbert is this, that, and the other. The one thing I would say is watching from afar and only seeing them in person once last year, and it was a bad game to see them, but it was a pretty stark contrast against Washington. It really looked like there was a talent deficit compared to the best years we've seen Oregon over the last decade.
That's
going to take a while to sort of, you know, rebuild that, I think.
Talking with George Schroeder, USA Today, talking about Willie Taggart going from South Florida to a program like Oregon. We've seen guys successful in college football's version of a mid-major. Urban Meyer, others maybe have struggled. How interesting do you find that storyline, a guy who succeeds at Boise State and what he might be capable of with the wallop of a major program behind him?
I find it, to me, it's one of the more fascinating stories going into the season next year. It's not a one-season story. That's
sure.
The thing. We want to find out if it, that kind of goes back to the previous question. But, I mean, it's an incremental progress thing. But that's always the question is, can guys make the leap and what happens when they get there? We've seen with Chris Peterson that it sure looks like he can make the leap. And I don't know that any of us really had a serious doubt about that, but until you get to that Power 5 program, to the platform where you can win big, 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 you don't really know that. Now, maybe it's a little bit different with Chris Peterson because Boise State, you know, came as close to TCU would be the only other that you would think of, and they got the call up to the Power 5, but Boise State came as close as any power group of 5, non-BCS, whatever program to cracking sort of the code to being a big boy as anybody. But that, to me, that's always a fascinating question. Can you do it at the next level?
We were talking about this before we went on the air of USC, and their just crazy run today of landing 5 stars and big recruits. And it seems like every time they go to the Rose Bowl and they win, or they go to some type of a big bowl game and they win, they always crush it on signing day. And like I asked with Oregon, expectations were already going to be through the roof because of Sam Darnold coming back next year, regardless of who's gone. But now with this class, it seems like Clay Helton really has USC moving in the direction everyone maybe thought Sark or Kiffin was going to have them moving. Is that fair to have this group as a top 5 or a top 3 team that, you know, we're going to see because they're USC?
Based on talent alone, yes, it's fair. And that's why I think the jury's still out on Clay Helton. I mean, I like him personally. I think he's a good X's and O's football coach, understands how the game is coached and stuff like that. But are you the guy to lead USC to the expectations that USC has every year? I don't know. And I think we're going to figure that out. He got a kind of a pass this year, I mean, which is amazing considering the start, and people were wondering if he'd even make it to the end of the year. But when they righted the ship, which, you know, started with changing quarterbacks, but when they righted the ship and turned into a much different program by the end of the season, obviously, he gets a pass for how they started. But here's the deal. You can't do that again. And I don't mean start slow. I mean you can't absorb 3 losses again when people expect you to be really, really good. I don't care when they come, at what point of the season. To me, I don't know if they live up to expectations or not. I would have them in my top five or six, and I'd have to sit here and think about who those teams would be. But I think they'd easily fit in a top five or six right now on February 1st for the preseason next year. But you know, I still think the jury's out on if Clay Helton is the guy who can take USC back to everything people think USC should be. And I think in those cases, the expectations for USC are pretty realistic because of its platform, because of its history, and its recent history. So is that the right ranking? I don't know, but we're going to find out in a pretty big hurry.
Kind of along those lines, more of a general question. I know locally people in Evanston and Corvallis and Columbia and Eugene don't want to hear this kind of mentality. But as somebody who views it through national eyes but understands the local take, when Oklahoma and Texas and Michigan and Ohio State and USC are powerhouses, kind of the blue bloods, does that add to, or do you kind of get into the dangerous area of, oh, there they go dominating again, nobody else has a chance? How do you see that when the blue bloods kind of are the power in a particular conference?
Are you talking about on the field or in the recruiting? We're talking about
I'm sorry, on field, because I think USC is here to stay for a while.
Yeah, I do too. And look, I think I'm not completely sure about Washington, but I think they were a little bit, and they may even take a half step back because of some of the defensive losses. But
right.
I do think that Chris Peterson has them on the, it's pretty clear, on a rapid ascent to being a power again, which, you know, there was a time when you thought maybe that will never happen again. It had been down for so long. So, look, I'm all for fresh stories. I mean, look, did anybody who wasn't already wearing a Crimson Tide pullover want Alabama to win, or did you want Clemson to win? I think most people, unless you had some sort of stake in there, wanted somebody new. You don't
right.
want Alabama to win all the time. And so I extrapolate that to your question, which is, it's fun when teams that are, I don't know what the word would be, upstarts or not the usual suspects, are the teams that are sort of doing things in a conference. That's what's been really cool, I think, in the Pac-12, was what Oregon did, you know, with a program that didn't have a ton of winning tradition until, you know, Rich Brooks got it going and Mike Bellotti took it a little bit higher, and then Chip Kelly took it where it never had been before, and then, you know, and Mark Helfrich got them back to a title game. You know, that's a fantastically cool story from that 30,000-foot view you're talking about. I like that a whole lot more than writing about, you know, is Nick Saban going to win his 78th national title in the last 82 years or whatever it is.
Right.
I think that's a little exaggeration, but it's close.
You look at locally here, everyone's fired up about this coaching staff that Taggart's hired, and I think it's justified. I think he's put together a really good really good group of coaches. But there's a school in Berkeley that I think has also assembled a really, really strong class, coaching class under Justin Wilcox. I'm curious what your take of the Sonny Dykes firing and then just the hiring of Wilcox and the guys he's hired, because on paper it looks like they may be just as impressive as Oregon's staff.
Well, let me just say one thing. I think there's a lot of really good coaching staffs out there. There's some bad ones, too, but I think there's a lot of really good coaching staffs and reasons to like them. What I think we don't know about either staff yet is this, and you only find this out later, is what's the cohesiveness inside the staff room?
Right.
And I think a lot of times that develops and it's overdone to think that there might be some questions there, but sometimes chemistry just doesn't really happen and you've got other agendas and things like that. Now, I don't have any sense that there are any issues in either of those two staffs, and so I agree that on paper, I think they're both really good. First of all, the Dyke story is an interesting story because of the timing of the firing. And, you know, I think it's a little suspect that, oh, well, he was interested in a Baylor job at this side or the other. There are some issues at Cal.
Yep.
It isn't just the head coach. The head coach had reasons to go look in other places because the commitment to football is I would say, shaky at Cal. So I get that. I also think that Sonny Dykes was not a good fit for them from the get-go, so there's that too. Justin Wilcox understands the score, and he certainly knows the West Coast, obviously, not just from having grown up in Junction City and been a Duck. I mean, just from coaching at Washington, coaching at USC.
He coached at Cal.
Absolutely. So, I mean, he gets it. I mean, there's a, you know, and The other thing is, now, the one thing I'd be interested in with that coaching staff is they're going to be recruiting under a whole different set of strictures than Oregon and every other coaching staff because of the situation they've got with the academic standards at Cal. And it'll be interesting to see what kind of classes they land. Whatever happens today with a new coaching staff happens. It's next year is when you start trying to figure out how good they're going to be at recruiting.
All right, George, final thought. Your current article on USA Today, kind of a growing trend. You hit on Oklahoma's got 11 new faces who enrolled early. Kind of, well, what's the benefit of this on both sides? And do you think we're headed towards, in fact, having that new early signing date, which might continue to push this trend to become even more frequent?
I think it might. I mean, look, it's not just Oklahoma. That was just one of them. But
right.
Alabama, which is going to finish sort of number one in everybody's rankings, or maybe number two, I haven't checked. I assume they're number one. Matt would know better than I would.
Yes, they are number one, shockingly.
And if you say they're number two, then you're probably in trouble with all the Bama fans. I get it. But, they've got 12 early enrollees. 12.
Wow.
That's the most ever in school history. It's also that 11 is the most in Oklahoma's history. Ohio State has 9. Texas A&M has 9. There are several others that have that. But if you look at it in the top 10 of those rankings, that's where several of those schools have a ton of early enrollees. And there are several different advantages there, including counting some of those guys back to the previous scholarship class, which allows you to sign more on National Signing Day. But the bigger deal is where it used to be one or two a year, and maybe a quarterback would come in early or whatever, you've now got a whole bunch of guys who are going to go through spring practice. They're going to have a full semester in Oregon's case, quarters. They're going to have a bunch of hours under the belt. They're going to have acclimated to school. And by the time they get around to next August for actual practices, they're not going to be homesick, you would expect. They're going to be physically stronger. They're going to be already sort of into the sort of mix of the team. And a lot of them have a better shot probably of playing right away or factoring in than they would have otherwise. And so it really helps the teams out potentially, and it really helps those players out. And I'll tell you what, if I could arrange that, if I'm a high school junior and I can figure out a way to get graduated in December and get in somewhere, I'm going to do it for a lot of reasons, including just thinking ahead. I'm going to graduate in 3 years with everybody taking, two summer sessions. And then I might well be a graduate transfer if things didn't go quite the way I wanted them to go. I mean, there's so many reasons it makes a lot of sense for the kids and the school.
Yeah, that actually played out here this season. Jaylen Brown enrolled early, redshirted, and has graduated as a sophomore eligibility-wise and has transferred to Northwestern for 2 more years, and he's able to play right away.
I think I think there's something to be said for your senior year of high school and missing out on sort of that second semester of your senior year. But if you're a highly motivated guy and you kind of got all your ducks lined up in a row, no pun intended, then you want to go ahead and move on out, then it can make a lot of sense for you. But I think it can also help your school too. In many cases, probably a win-win. And I do think, in answer to your original question, Steve, I do think we're going to see it become more and more of a trend. Now, you have to have room to do it on sort of your roster numbers, both the
right.
Previous year to 25, this year to 25, and the 85 scholarship limit. It gets a little more – it's kind of complicated sometimes. But if you have room to do it, the more kids you can get in early, the better. And if, as expected, there's an early December signing day next year, in addition to this one, this traditional one, you may find a lot of kids who take that early signing day option, going ahead and going early. It might just sort of jumpstart our mental mindset to leaving early and showing or enrolling early.
Wow.
Yeah, I think Oregon's had
two
six or
LOI
seven.
Days. I don't know if Preem could handle it.
No, I can't.
Diminish this one in terms of the hype. Sorry,
yeah.
Sorry, Matt.
No, I'm all for it. If I don't have to get up, especially now at 3 a.m. to be ready by 4, I'm okay with that.
Right.
Well,
hey.
I possibly think some of the circus maybe I'll be wrong, but I think it's possible that some of the circus could go away based on this.
We'll just get more commitment videos now if it's in December with Santa Claus and reindeer, because naturally that's going to happen.
That's probably right.
That's a scary.
Probably right.
All right, we've gone down a very dark rabbit hole here. George, great insight and info as always. USAtoday.com on Twitter, at George Schroeder. Thanks so much, George. Awesome stuff. We'll catch up with you next week.
Thanks, George.
All right, thanks, guys. Take care.
All right, take it easy.